Good afternoon, and welcome to today's Deloitte Fireside Chat Part 1 on the role of professional judgment in accounting and auditing, broadcast live on www.sechistorical.org, the virtual museum and archive of the SEC Historical Society. I'm Silvana Palmrose, PricewaterhouseCoopers Auditing Professor and Professor of Accounting in the Marshall School of Business at the University of Southern California, and moderator for today's program. The Deloitte Fireside Chats, both Part 1 today and Part 2 to be broadcast next Wednesday, October 28th, are made possible through a partnership between Deloitte LLP and the SEC Historical Society. Deloitte LLP is the brand under which over 160,000 dedicated professionals in independent firms throughout the world collaborate to provide audit, consulting, financial advisory, risk management, and tax services to selected clients. The SEC Historical Society is a nonprofit organization which preserves and shares the history of financial regulation through its unique virtual museum and archive at www.sechistorical.org. The museum is free and accessible worldwide at all times. The Society and Museum are independent of and separate from the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission and receive no funding from the public sector. The Society is grateful for the support of Deloitte in making possible these programs. Today, I'm delighted to welcome Gregory Jonas, who serves on the PCAOB Standing Advisory Group and was a member of the SEC Advisory Committee on Improvements to Financial Reporting, and Robert Kippers, Deputy CEO of Deloitte and a trustee of the SEC Historical Society. Our conversation today will be an interactive one, exploring the role of professional judgment in accounting and auditing. But before we begin the program, I'd like to state that the views of the presenters are their own and do not reflect those of Deloitte or the SEC Historical Society. The Society is responsible for the selection of the moderator and the presenters. Our discussion today will be guided by questions suggested by the presenters, by a planning team from Deloitte, including Lauren Bond, Consuelo Hitchcock, Misty Jenkins-Saldi, and Raymond Lewis, and by questions submitted by visitors to the website prior to this fireside chat. Our session recognizes that the meaning of professional judgment and its application in accounting and auditing have become subjects of interest and discussion for standard setters, preparers, auditing professionals, investors, regulators, and faculty and students alike. The SEC's Advisory Committee on Improvements to Financial Reporting, also known as CIFER, which issued its final report in August 2008, represents the latest in a series of public policy initiatives to focus on professional judgment in accounting and auditing. So let's begin with CIFER. Greg, you served on this SEC Advisory Committee. Why did CIFER take on the issue of professional judgment?
Well, Silvana, it's a pleasure to be with you here today. And let me say that like many recommendations, they begin with perceived problems, and the recommendation is trying to cure the perceived problems. And I think the CIFER group identified five or so things that gave us cause for concern that we thought a judgment framework could help. These are, for example, many restatements that we perceived resulted from deemed errors in judgment. Second is we heard from regulators that they believe that there are many cases of unpersuasive or undersupported judgments being made by practitioners. Companies and auditors told us that they believe that from time to time, regulators did not respect their reasonable judgments, and they substituted the regulator's personal preferences for reasonable judgments in requiring revisions to financial statements or in citing audit deficiencies. So you can see there's somewhat of a mistrust here between, on the one hand, preparers and auditors, and on the other hand, the regulatory community on the subject of judgment. The fourth concern that we saw was confusion in practice as to what constitutes a persuasive judgment. I mean, really, in the auditing literature and in the accounting literature, the profession really has never addressed what constitutes, what are the qualities of a persuasive judgment. And then finally, we see a demand for detailed rules as a substitute for professional judgment, which undermines the goal of principle-based standards. So there's kind of a defeatist, self-reinforcing bad loop here of practice demanding ever more detailed rules so that they won't be second-guessed by overseers about the quality of their judgment. So for all these reasons, these are the problems that we saw. We thought that a judgment framework could then serve the following goals. First, improve, and most importantly, I might add, improve the quality and the reliability of judgments that are made in practice. Second is to improve, prepare, and auditor confidence that regulators will indeed respect reasonable judgments. Third is to establish criteria for judgments and thereby reduce uncertainty about the characteristics of sound judgment. In other words, clarify what people are looking for from judgment. And then finally, enable principle-based standards. So these are the important goals that we had in mind.
Zubana, let me add that this fundamental question of why did the committee take it on, I have to tell you, I think the Cypher Group, in terms of its willingness to take on the tough issues, its the quality of its work product, and the fact that many of its recommendations were very operational, or things that you could make operational, speaks to the quality and really fine work that group did. And as I look back at the roster of talent and their willingness to take on things that others have decided are too complicated, speaks volumes in terms of what a good body of work that really was.
Well, a listener has asked that we probe the distinction between judgments and decisions. So, Bob, what do you think Cypher means by judgments, and do they differ from decisions?
Actually, that's an excellent question, because as I think of it, maybe it's sort of like a continuum. There's decisions, there's judgments, and then there's professional judgments in my mind. And it is true that all judgments, professional or otherwise, would be viewed as decisions, but not all decisions necessarily involve judgment. Where we should be talking today in this session is about the professional judgments, because those are decisions made against the backdrop of professional education, training, specific experience in a field. And I think that, importantly, the context, if you're an auditor, that's kind of the perspective I bring here today, involves this whole notion of due care, objectivity, integrity, skepticism, independence. So it's in that context of making a judgment about, a professional matter, whether you be a company or an auditor, that I think distinguishes professional judgment from the everyday kind of decisions that we make all the time.
Let me pile on a little bit by agreeing with Bob that this is an interesting question, but I don't think that Cypher ever addressed the distinction between a decision and a judgment. But I think what we had in mind with judgments are things that involved important matters, big material items, where difference in judgment would create very different looking financial statements. Second is, characteristic of a judgment is, there are reasonable alternatives that could have been selected. And which one to pick is somewhat uncertain. So it's this range of possibilities that constitutes the need for judgment. Whereas some decisions are just obvious. There's only one answer, for example. Here we're not talking about one answer. We're talking about a range of reasonably possible answers. So there's some controversy to a judgment. Reasonable people can look at the same set of facts and get different answers. And so we're talking gray area type areas. That's what I think Cypher had in mind when we wrote this.
Okay, and that's what they called professional judgment. So let's talk about the Cypher's final report contains some recommendations that are related specifically to professional judgment. So, Greg, maybe it'd be useful at this stage to give our listeners a brief summary of what these recommendations are.
Well, Zivana, there are three broad areas of these recommendations in the judgment framework area. One is that the SEC should adopt a judgment framework for accounting judgments. I'm sure we'll talk about this more in a few minutes. The PCAOB should also adopt a similar framework with respect to auditing related judgments. And that, importantly, this guidance from the SEC and PCAOB should be done in a way to take care that we implement it in a way that does not limit the work of auditors and regulators to oversee and to second-guess judgments. There's no goal here of trying to reduce people's ability to second guess.
You know, I don't want to disagree, Greg, but I will tell you that I think a lot of the impetus behind making certain that CIFER, you know, waded into this whole area and came up with these recommendations had to come from the preparer community, the corporate community, the folks that prepare the financial statements, because if you look at the backdrop of unprecedented numbers of restatements, working with clients all the time that I would say 20 years ago would have not accepted a suggestion from the regulator in reviewing a filing that they should process a restatement, more likely to do so now, partly in the belief that they were never going to win on the issue and that they were, in fact, being second-guessed, but the folks they were being second-guessed by sort of held all the cards. So I think that I agree with you, it's vitally important that these recommendations come forward, but I think a lot of it came from a certain amount of frustration on the part of the corporate community that prepares the financial statements, feeling like they needed a place to stand that they could feel was safe ground.
Yeah, Bob, certainly we did hear that from the preparer and the auditor communities.
Well, let's pick up on this recommendation for the articulation of a judgment framework. So what would be the concepts that support CIFER's proposed judgment framework?
Well, one concept is that the judgment framework would not and should not eliminate debate. This isn't about narrowing choice, eliminating debate. It's about trying to improve the quality of judgment. A second concept is the framework organizes analysis and focuses preparers and others on areas to be addressed, and thereby it improves the quality of judgment and the likelihood that auditors and regulators will accept the judgments that have been made by practice. Another concept is the use of hindsight to evaluate a judgment where the relevant facts were not available at the time of the initial release of the financial statements is not appropriate. So hindsight with 2020, with new facts only available recently, is really kind of out of bounds with regard to the judgment framework. A corollary to that is that those who evaluate judgments should evaluate the reasonableness of the judgment and should not base their evaluation on whether the judgment differs from their personal first choice. So this is, what is the ballpark of the range of reasonableness, and is the judgment supportable in lines of the criteria that we'll talk about in a few minutes? Importantly, we did not have the notion that the framework would be mandatory. This is not a mandatory framework. That is, choosing to not follow the framework would not imply that you've made an inappropriate or weak judgment. And finally, the framework is used on a very selective basis. It is intended, as I mentioned earlier, for major, sensitive, complex, or highly uncertain judgments. I think it would be overkill for the many of the thousands of judgments used in the preparation of public company financial statements to apply this full framework.
You know, Greg, some of the those points really resonate with me because I think a lot of what we're talking about feels a little bit like Back to the Future. This notion of a framework is largely sort of a disciplined approach to common sense. I mean, you need to get to an answer. It needs to be a good, solid answer. But I do feel that we all have our own remembrances. But, you know, 20 years ago when I was working at the SEC, if a company whose financial statements were being challenged came in and they had, in their view, substantial authoritative support for their position, it was often the case that the staff would suggest that they may not prefer their accounting, but that their job was not to put their preference over that of a company if there were two ways to go, but rather suggest that the company reconsider their accounting in the future. But the notion of a restatement, you know, got out of the room pretty quickly if they had that support. So part of this feels right to me because it totally aligns with kind of the world of, you know, that I grew up in, frankly, as a professional. And I feel like we've gotten away to it and are now getting back to some real fundamentals.
Okay, well, let's talk about what CIFER actually suggested, because they actually did in the final report, which maybe we should mention is available on the SEC's website, so that the final report and the draft reports actually are available to the public. But CIFER did suggest some details on the components of a judgment framework. And I may be recalling this, I hope correctly, that the final report actually has like about 11 or 12, and we probably don't have time time to go into all of those, but maybe, Greg, you could give our listeners just a flavor for what these components are.
Right. Well, the framework, you know, has two main sections. One is about developing a critical thought process, and the second bronze section is about documenting what you've come up with. The critical thought process itself has 12 components to it. And a component is an area to be considered when making a judgment. Most of these components, and I agree with Bob's observation, back to the future, some of it common sense, I think most of the components are indeed obvious and are widely used already in practice in making accounting judgments today. Let me give you some examples of things I think that we routinely see. Analysis of the transaction and related facts. Analysis of applicable accounting literature. Disclosure in financial statements about the judgment or estimate consistent with today's reporting standards. Input from people with an appropriate level of expertise. And then giving judgment in an appropriate amount of time and effort at the right point in the accounting or audit process. I think these are examples of the 12 that people would nod and say, yeah, that's just intuitive, it makes sense, there's no earth-shattering new news here. Documentation being the second main component of the framework, the notion here, and again, I think this is widely understood in practice, is that the documentation should be made at the same time as you're making the judgment and in no later than the release of the financial statements. You know, it always frustrates, and I think rightfully so, it frustrates those who oversee judgments to see documentation being made, you know, the day before because you got called in to account for what your judgment is, all of a sudden the documentation shows up. It just calls in question about whether indeed you had thought it through at the time.
Well, taken together, let me just ask, do these components represent a process for reaching sound judgments? What I'm really trying to get at here is Cipher suggesting that those who might second-guess judgment, say, for example, regulators or even auditors, focus more on the process for reaching a judgment and less on the judgment itself?
Right. This is a really important question you ask, Zalana. I really want to emphasize this, that what Cipher had in mind for components is not a process. Processes can be flowcharting. Processes are things that you input data, you follow a decision tree, and at the end comes an answer. And that's not what this is at all. Rather, they are areas for consideration that any reasoned judgment can be more persuasive if the following areas are thought of when you're making the judgment. That's all that this is. I don't want to make it sound like it's some sophisticated rocket science thing. I would observe that I think second-guessing is a healthy part of any well-controlled process. And the goal of this framework is certainly not to restrict second-guessing. Rather, it's to improve judgment quality and thereby the acceptability and the credibility of the judgment with those charged with second-guessing them. So it's more likely that regulators and overseers will accept a judgment made if the judgments have considered the criteria that Cipher has outlined.
I'm struggling a little bit because, Zalana, you referred to auditors as second guessers, and
provocative.
I guess we could be viewed that way. But, Greg, I take your point. I think that to suggest that this is a mechanistic approach is completely undermines the value of this framework. It is a logical approach. It's one that, depending on the issue at hand, certain elements may take a very small role and others may be expanded. I mean, it would vary depending on what it is that you're trying to reach a decision about. And I think that's the point. It's got to be extremely flexible. And I would tell you that I think, when it comes to SEC enforcement cases against companies or auditors, PCAOB enforcement cases against auditors, some of the regime of inspection that we're used to in the last 6 or so years in the public accounting profession, I think it should reduce the number of times, hopefully, that there is a disagreement or there is you kind of reach a bit of gridlock sometimes in deciding what's acceptable and what's not. So I don't know that it would reduce. You're saying it's not designed to reduce second guessing, but I think if arguments are equally viable, in other words, you're defending a judgment because you followed the framework, and others are questioning whether that judgment is sound, you could end up perhaps in more cases where you kind of end up in a tie. And the way I'd like to think about it is maybe the tie should go to the runner. In this case, the runner would be the company preparing the financial statements or the auditor whose work is being questioned. We often say when we're working with the SEC on questions and issues with clients is that, you know, sometimes getting to a tie is not a bad place. Something more behind that we should probably explore a little bit further about this, the whole notion of second guessing. At least that's my sense.
Well, Greg, you said that maybe we'll get at this through this question. You said that some of the components seem obvious, but then that must mean that others might be more difficult to meet and may not be consistently applied in practice today. Would you have thoughts, and maybe Bob, you probably have thoughts on this too, on which components might be more difficult or perhaps new to practice?
Well, I think some are more difficult, as you mentioned, and here are my favorite three. Okay, Greg's top most difficult elements of the judgment framework. First is to articulate not only what you've decided, but what was in the running that you rejected, the so-called alternative views, including the pros and cons for those views, and now here, you know, and the reasons for these alternatives and the reasons they were rejected. So in other words, justifying a judgment to someone is as much about what you didn't pick as it is about what you did pick. And on the stuff you didn't pick, you need to outline why it was in the running, because chances are your critics felt that that was their best choice, you know, what you've rejected. So you've got to outline why it was in the running in the first place, acknowledge its merits, and then explain why it is that you didn't pick that one, that you picked another one, that its pros and cons outweighed the one that is probably somebody else's first choice. So I think this is, I don't see in when folks document and discuss their judgments, they almost spend almost all their time on what they chose as opposed to what they didn't choose. So that, I think, is tough. My second tough area is to explain your rationale. That's not new, but here's the hard part. Including the linkage of your rationale to two things. Link it to investors' information needs. So I see a lot of judgments justified on what I call internal baseball, which are factors that are internal to the company or internal to the audit firm. For example, I didn't have the data readily available, so I chose an alternative that I had data available that I could plug and play, for example. Or the cost of one alternative greatly exceeded the cost of another, so I rejected the one with the high cost. Those are very important points, but I call them internal baseball points. This linkage point I'm making is you link to the what's in the best interest of investors. Now, not always would you pick that particular one. There may be times when it's just not at all practical to pick a particular alternative, even though if you did have the data, it might be better for investors. But at least think about the investors and what would be best for them. I don't really see that done all that much today. And then the second linkage in this rationale that I think is tough is link what you're thinking to the judgments of competent external parties. So, for example, if everybody in practice is following the taste great method of an accounting issue and you've decided less filling is the way to go, you know, I think you're going to have a hard row to toe with regulators because, you know, consistency of practice and comparability of financial data is darn important. So I think this linkage notion to investors and then the judgments of competent external folks is something that, you know, gets you out of internal baseball, and it's hard to do. I find myself liking internal baseball more than I am external linkage in my own personal judgments, and it's just hard to do, but I think it's the thing that brings credibility and competence to a judgment. The third on my wish list is, or on my difficult list, I should say, is the reliability of assumptions and the data used. I see in some pretty big judgment areas that people almost take for granted that whatever data the company has available or whatever data the system might have spit out is a credible starting point for the judgment. And they don't often say, wait, how do we know this data is any good? And, of course, garbage in, garbage out. So, really scrutinizing the data to make sure it's of the quality of the analysis that goes into the judgment as a start point is something that's useful. So those are my top three tough areas.
You know, Greg, those are actually excellent points because they put really a sharper focus on the elements that are most difficult. I would point out, though, as I was listening to you, it occurred to me that for most companies who have really worked hard over the last 5, 6, 7 years on the ability to have appropriate technical consultative resources within their organization, they're so much better today because of 404, frankly, in terms of documenting, putting together an initial technical paper about a tough issue that they're facing, in part because, they risk without that not having the adequate internal resources to determine their own accounting answers. But my point is that the distance they would have to travel from where they are today to compliance with this framework, if we said it was ready to go, here we go, let's use it, is so much less than it would have been, pre Sarbanes-Oxley, for example. Because I think we're seeing our clients being much more deliberate in their approach to answering those questions. But the points you raise about assumptions and data, all those, there's always room for improvement, and I think this would take it sort of to the next level. But I think a lot of companies are well suited to live in a world like this.
Well, we should probably emphasize that the CIFR recommendation actually calls for the SEC to articulate this framework for accounting judgments, and that this judgment framework then would be issued as a policy statement from the commission. Greg, why did CIFR think such an SEC policy statement would be helpful?
Well, because of, the regulators' enforcement authority and their ability to take tough action, obviously what regulators think heavily influences practice. And so transparency by regulators in how they evaluate judgments both helps practice understand expectations, and it's also likely to strongly influence practice in the direction of whatever guidance the regulator chooses to issue. A policy statement is a statement by the commission as opposed to a statement by the staff, like a staff accounting bulletin. But this is a statement, a formal statement by the commission, and it's likely, therefore, to influence staff behavior within the commission across the commission. So it would influence Corp Fin in the comment letters. It would influence the Office of Chief Accountants when they get into accounting issues and help Corp Fin think through what is acceptable and what not. It would also influence enforcement and how enforcement looks at the world. And it would do so more than if the guidance were issued by just the staff of one of those divisions, for example. So we thought that a commission document was useful. And also a policy statement isn't mandatory rules. It's here's how the commission looks at certain things, or here are factors the commission considers when considering the qualities of a judgment. And so we don't want the judgment framework to be, a rule binding, as I mentioned earlier, but yet we do want it to be something that regulators and use because it will influence practice in the interest of the public interest.
So let me just jump in there because the beneficiaries of a policy statement are actually pretty broad. Not only does it provide direction to the staff and the commission itself, but then reporting companies, auditors, attorneys, others that work with the staff all the time would have knowledge and see this framework as something they should expect to work with as they go forward, yet it doesn't suffer the burden of the commission telling people how you must make a decision. And I think they've shied away from that, you know, as fundamentally not telling people that you have to follow in lockstep some approach. So it kind of gets the best of both.
Agreed, Bob. And there are some examples that were in the CIFRA report of previous policy statements made by the commission that we thought Bob met the criteria that you outlined. It had the win-win kind of advantages that you just alluded to, and that's why CIFRA, I think, kind of became enamored with this concept.
Well, that's great, but in all honesty, while the CIFRA recommendation has garnered much support, it's not been without controversy either. In particular, I can remember when CIFRA first proposed it in a draft report, there was a good deal of pushback. So why was this so?
Zavanna, there were three reasons why I think the critics criticized what we were thinking. One is that they felt that it could undermine legitimate second-guessing by regulators and overseers by reducing their ability to object to unreasonable judgments that, quote, comply with the framework. A related point, in effect, the judgment framework would thus create, in their view, a safe harbor for judgments that comply in form with the framework, regardless of the quality of the judgment. And thus, it could undermine their third concern. Thus, it could undermine quality as practice seeks more to comply with the framework than on making the best judgment. Now, my answer to these concerns, and these were heartfelt concerns by very serious folks. I mean, these were not dismissed lightly by CIFRA, but at the end of the day, I believed that if we were proposing a process, I would have these concerns. Something where we were proposing something where you input data and out comes an answer, I could understand that form could drive substance here. But this doesn't tell you what to do. It doesn't tell you what the judgment ought to be. It simply says, think hard about these 11 areas, and in doing so, you will be more persuasive, you will come up with a better, more reasoned judgment, and that's what we have in mind.
Greg, you mentioned that as a complement to its recommendation for an SEC policy statement on accounting judgments, that CIFRA also recommended that the PCAOB issue a policy statement on audit judgments in the context of PCAOB auditing standards. So maybe this would be a good time, Bob, to ask you, what's incremental here about judgment from an audit perspective that would support this kind of recommendation?
Well, I think it's important to just admit or declare here that it would be impossible for you to do an audit without an incredible number of judgments. And while they may be a little different than the registrant or the client company's accounting decisions, judgments made in the course of an audit are pretty fundamental, including and starting with the identification of risk. Determining, you know, how to address those risks by designing your tests, what materiality is, the scope, timing, and nature of audit tests, and probably the ultimate judgment, the one that's sort of the bottom line from an auditor's perspective, is when do you have sufficient, competent, evidential matter to support the opinion you ultimately issue? And I think each and every of these judgments is key to the delivery of high-quality audits, and therefore goes right to the heart of investor protection. So I think, given the good work of CIFRA, it would be important to have a policy statement from the PCAOB. It could be a companion piece, a parallel piece. It might look a little different, but I believe it would include the same kinds of, you know, what I called before, a disciplined approach to common sense that would signal to the firms who do this work what is the standard to which they would be held. And of course, key to that, as with the accounting decisions by our clients, is the documentation piece that in the end pulls together why you did what you did and serves as the record for the future.
You know, I've been struck in thinking about the judgments of auditors versus the judgments of St. Prepare's, just how much they have in common, particularly in a post-Starbucks world. I was hard-pressed to think about things that auditors judge that the Prepare doesn't have to judge. You know, I was initially thinking about things like sample sizes and things that I kind of thought fell uniquely in the auditor's purview. But I think the Prepare is saddled with all the same kind of stuff because they have to ensure that their books and records are accurate. And so they need to be thinking like auditors as they design their internal controls and their internal processes. So I really think we have a lot in common. Now, that raises the question, okay, Greg, if you're right, that the judgments are very similar between the Prepare and the auditor, why does the PCAOB need to do anything then? Why not just have the SEC? And my answer is the PCAOB also should, as a regulator and an important influencer of practice in the auditing profession, it too should signal what it looks for in judgment quality, particularly if they feel in any way that it's incremental to what the SEC might say. And so it's the transparency and the benefits that come from declaring yourself as to what you look for in a judgment that is, you know, the benefits from that are as good from the PCAOB as they are, in my view, from the SEC. And that's why CIFR, I think, recommended that both should declare themselves. It would be healthy for everybody in this judgment framework.
That's very well said because, you know, given that we, certainly the largest firms are inspected annually, you know, if you sort of have the playbook and know what to expect, then it's more likely that you can comport with the expectations of the regulators that ultimately have to weigh in.
Okay, well, we have some questions from some listeners, and so maybe this is a good time to probe those a little. The first one are questions that ask us to explore professional judgment within public accounting firms. And let's talk about whether, for example, high-quality professional judgment is identified within public accounting firms. And if it is identified, what are the factors that represent high quality?
I'm struck by the question. I think the listener in this case really has hit on an important element because, you know, it's very easy for people to think, well, all right, it's one thing for a company to prepare its financial statements, but when it comes to auditors, you know, the firms probably don't value these kinds of skills, and honestly, nothing could be further from the truth. If you have auditors who, as they progress in their career, ultimately, if they stay with the firm, the kind of person you want to admit to the firm as a partner are the kind of people that have the capacity, the will, the strength to reach judgments, to stand behind their work, and so the way we talk to our young people about it and the way we kind of train around applying professional judgment in the audit world have many of the elements that CIFR laid out, although I don't think we really have 12. It boils down to the same common sense approach that, you know, the toughest thing often in auditing is issue identification. If you know, identifying the issue is step one. But once you do, then gathering the facts around it, reviewing all the relevant literature that might bear on the nature and scope of your audit test and figuring out exactly what you're testing for, a full analysis, including getting in experts and those that understand you know, the technical side of auditing and consult if it makes sense to do so. But at the end of the day, once you've got all those elements and pieces and you've discussed it fully, reaching a decision, in other words, conclude, and then importantly, documenting. I mean, they're the same. It's the same approach applied to a different discipline. And when it comes to auditing the client's accounting judgments, it's exactly the same framework. But I'm just saying, when you think of it from the audit standpoint, it's a very parallel process. And it's one that we do value highly, and the people who are the most successful and have the most longevity in the firms are the ones that are able to master an appropriate way to reach judgments. And, you know, we always say that the judgments you want are the ones that stand the test of time.
Yeah, I think back to my years in public accounting, Bob, and I can't think of an evaluation form I either wrote or read that didn't address, almost as a cornerstone issue, what is the person's judgment quality. What I've found curious is, actually, until I served on this CIFER committee, I hadn't really thought hard about what does that mean, the person's got good judgment. I mean, what differentiates a good judgment versus a non-good judgment? And I think this so-called judgment framework, again, I don't think it's rocket science. Common sense does come to mind. But yet, I think those 12 things are the attributes one means when one says this person has good judgment. It means they can make a choice, defend it, and support it against not only the choice itself, but against the reasonable alternatives. And that's what we meant all those years when we were writing about good judgment in these evaluations.
And the way you would see that would be through the successive layers of review of an individual's work. You know, the next person up the chain and the manager and the partner, the fact is that those that were the most successful were the folks that that survived all those reviews. And if challenged and asked, they were able to explain exactly what they did and point you to the documentation that proves it.
And that's probably why regulators would remind us all that that's the important role they serve, is as providing that oversight and that second guessing. It drives practice to think it through more than perhaps otherwise would be the case. And that's why I think regulators believe they're very much in the public interest, and I happen to agree with them.
I just think that you're very positive on the second-guessing stuff, and I'm not sure I'm in the same place. But I mean,
Bob, you're second-guessing my comment.
There you go. I'm sorry.
No. I wouldn't try to second-guess either one of you. But before we move off of CIFER, it's noteworthy that the CIFER report came out more than a year ago, and neither the Commission nor the PCAOB have formally acted on any of its recommendations yet, including the recommendation related to accounting and auditing judgments. I know our listeners would be very interested in each of your perspectives on the path forward here. So let's spend a few minutes exploring your thoughts on what will happen. For example, does it matter who acts first, or is any action by the Commission and PCAOB even essential?
Let me take that one first. I think it's interesting, in terms of the passage of time, you noted the fact that it's been a little over a year. I'd like to believe that if the last year hadn't been so difficult on so many fronts, that maybe things would have been a little further along. But I think the reality is that we've had the recession, we've had the economic crisis, we've had all the markets roiled and everything that's taken up so much of our joint time. Plus, we have really a new administration in Washington, a new chairman at the SEC. Just weeks ago, Jim Croker was named chief accountant. So, I mean, it's been one of those unusual periods of time. But we are where we are. So as we think about moving forward, it's still my hope that the Commission, in the foreseeable future at least, would take up and consider whether such a framework should be put forward. I think it's one of the more important elements of CIFER. And in speaking with certain of the commissioners, there was encouragement that we shouldn't forget this good work. It shouldn't sit on the shelf and gather dust. We should pick it up and see what makes sense to deal with. And I do believe, however, that it's likely the SEC should act first. I think it would be unlikely that the PCAOB would get out ahead of the SEC on this, because I think the idea would be, once the SEC finishes its work on this and gets a policy statement together, even if it's, I don't know, if they went out for notice and comment, for example, that would be a time when there's a solid draft. At that point, the PCAOB certainly could pick up the pencil and decide how their framework would align with it. But I would think they would fit together pretty nicely. So my urging would be for the Commission to take it up first and the PCAOB to sort of be a fast follower and taking their lead from the Commission. You know, Greg, is that square with what you were thinking?
It does. I think it's essential that the SEC and the PCAOB act because they are important aspects of driving practice, as we discussed earlier. Absent their action, I don't think this is going to catch fire, as it should. I do believe, as Bob does, that the first step should be the SEC takes action, and followed shortly thereafter by PCAOB action. Interestingly, I was at an advisory council meeting just last week of the PCAOB, and the chief auditor reported, when discussing the PCAOB's agenda, that the board has decided that they will add a project on the judgment framework if the SEC takes any action related to the judgment framework. So they are waiting for the SEC to take action. By implication, absent SEC action, the PCAOB does not intend to act.
Well, that's certainly a strong signal that what we were just talking about is likely to be the direction. But I do wonder this, Greg, and even Zovana, whether you have a thought. You said earlier in your remarks that the strongest element of this would be a commission policy statement, and that it would have so much more breadth of coverage across the SEC than an individual staff declaration or, you know, the equivalent of a staff accounting bulletin. While this is all under consideration, though, would it be possible to implement this almost in administrative practice short of a commission policy statement?
Well, you mean by, say, one of the divisions?
Well, yeah, I mean, I guess it would have to be either in Corp Fin or OCA or, you know.
My guess is, and Zovana, you were there, you know the place better than I do, but my strong sense is that if one of the divisions had a strong objection, for example, let's say the Office of Chief Accountant decided that they would go forward with an administrative piece under their office, and enforcement jumped up and said, no, we don't agree with the direction that this is going. We're afraid that this is going to undermine some of our enforcement capability. I can't see that OCA could ever issue such a document.
So at which point you're at the commission anyway for resolution.
Go.
So
there you go. That's how we got to a commission policy statement. Zovana,
I would just have a slightly different perspective in that if you look at the components of the judgment framework, they're very consistent with the advice that OCA gives for consultations on accounting issues, OCA and Corp Fin. So that, in all honesty, behind the scenes here, much of this is working away as part of just the natural framework for the consultation process. So that doesn't diminish the advantage of a policy statement from the commission, but I think it is noteworthy that this is consistent with the way that the staff does approach consultations.
Yeah, I would also observe that Jim Croker, now the chief accountant, was very active in the CFIR deliberations when he was deputy, and Jim has said that he believes a judgment policy statement should be a high priority for the SEC, and I doubt Jim would have made that comment unless he thought he had support within the commission to do it. So right now I'm optimistic. I'm a little disappointed. Action hasn't taken place to date. Obviously, these are unprecedented times with the credit crisis, but I think now's the time to hustle this forward, and I really hope that the SEC takes quick action.
And I guess just for our listeners, so that you're not confused, we refer to the as a CIFR, CIFR, CIFR. So all of those mean the same advisory committees. So we apologize that we can't converge on the pronunciation for an acronym, but we do mean them all to be the same.
I'd like to pile on with just one more point to speaking of the PCAOB, and that is the board has a project on its agenda now, standard-setting project, to reconsider auditor communications with audit committees. And, you know, one of the areas of communication will be, of course, sensitive judgments and estimates that the auditor would talk to the audit committee about that management has made. And several of us who were at the advisory council meeting observed that a judgment framework could certainly help an auditor communicate about it's a neat framework for talking about how somebody arrived at a judgment and why you found it acceptable. So I think it could serve that purpose as well.
It's an excellent point. I mean, audit committees in particular, even though I understand that it's not a process, but they would take some comfort for appreciating the deliberative elements that went into making that decision as they oversee the financial reporting process.
I mean, I would suspect more than a few audit committee chairs are going to expect that, you know, if they became knowledgeable of the judgment framework, that they would say, all right, for these big deal, not 200, but the handful of really sensitive, important judgments each year in our company's financial statements, I would like explained to me in common plain English, in terms of the framework, why the judgment makes sense. I could see audit committee members asking that, even absent an SEC policy statement.
Are you recommending that we have a separate judgment framework for audit committees that they have to follow in order to...
Sounds like overkill to me.
All right, okay. Good idea, run amok.
Well, it sounds like it's time to change directions a little.
Okay.
But in a recent speech, Jim Croker, SEC chief accountant, reported that in the upcoming months, the commission will refocus on considering the use of international financial reporting standards by U.S. companies. And IFRS is considered a more principles-based approach to accounting standards as compared to U.S. GAAP, which is often labeled as rules-based. And next week, on October 28th, part two of the Deloitte Fireside Chats will explore principles versus rules-based accounting and auditing standards. But to tee up that session, perhaps we could spend our remaining time conversing on the implications of IFRS and the SEC's IFRS initiative for professional judgment, and then even vice versa, the implications of professional judgment for IFRS and the SEC's initiative. Bob, would you like to get us started?
Absolutely. There's sort of an obvious nexus between the conversation in the first part of our program today and this question. There are some that might suggest, and I'd probably be either in this crowd or right on the fringe of it, the group that says, is it possible that an IFRS world, let's say it's the United States as part of the IFRS world, could function effectively without more discipline or more consistency on how one approaches professional judgments? In other words, maybe I'm maybe speaking to the second part first, but the point is that IFRS implementation in the United States, I think, would be difficult without some progress on this front, that I think it would leave open too much in the way of confusion and expectations. We can debate how principles-based versus rules-based IFRS, those standards are, but, you know, part of it is they're relatively young in their life cycle compared to U.S. GAAP, and they haven't really... they don't cover every little thing, and they certainly don't cover some industry areas, and there's some holes in it, I guess you could say. But it's pretty apparent that despite all the events of this year, that the SEC understands the need to deal with the roadmap, to take some next steps, and in the bargain, they're going to be signaling some kind of approach. My own bias is that it's likely that IFRS is inevitable in the United States, but I have no predictions as to when. There's a tremendous number of issues to be overcome before it's a reality. But every one of them comes right back to this whole issue of judgment. And it's true in the audit firms. It's true in the preparing community. It's certainly true in the regulatory community. If you were to fast forward to some future date and we were having the same conversations we're having today, but about financial statements prepared under IFRS, I think we would all be looking for some common ground to stand on to make sure that we could cycle through the reviews and all the things that need to get done to raise capital.
I'll make an editorial observation about cookbook rules versus principle-based standards. Here's what's not controversial. I don't know of an accountant in the world who would disagree that accounting standards ought to be objectives-oriented and principles-based. Those two things, you know, are not controversial at all. The controversy starts where what beyond principles should guidance provide? And that's where there gets to be debate, because some people believe that accounting standards ought to be principle-only standards. And others believe that there is a very appropriate place in an accounting standard for implementation guidance below the principal level, but something above cookbook rules that is necessary to get practice to a reasonable level of comparability. Because comparability among companies in similar economic circumstances is key to the investor analysis. Put me in the second camp. I am very much a believer that implementation guidance has a legitimate place in the accounting literature, and I'm not a principal-only guy, but I certainly believe that all accounting guidance ought to be objectives-oriented, principles-based. For those of you who haven't read it, the SEC did a study, I believe, in response to the Sarbanes-Oxley Act on principle versus rule-based standards, and I thought it was just wonderfully written and very balanced, where they explain much more eloquently than I just did this debate about how deep accounting standards ought to go. So the problem, though, that everybody also agrees on is the problem with detailed rules is that they often draw arbitrary lines that distort economic reality. And the poster child for this is leasing literature, where we clearly have cookbook, we clearly have arbitrary lines, and at least the major investment houses that I'm aware all routinely adjust financial statements to capitalize operating leases because they believe they've created property rights and commitments. So I don't think detailed rules is the way to go either. So whether we're talking then some reasonable level of implementation guidance or principle only, I certainly agree with Bob, we're in the game of professional judgment, inevitably, and that's not bad. It's actually healthy. So we need to promote professional judgment. We don't want to undermine it. And that's really what this judgment framework is all about. Now, what we have going in the last few years is a vicious circle downward, and that is because people are so second-guessed by multiple levels. The poor practitioner is second-guessed by their internal audit function, auditor, the PCAOB, the SEC Enforcement Division, plaintiff counsel. There's no end to the second-guessing. That it drives people to ask standard setters to create ever more detailed rules so that they can prove compliance and be beyond second-guessing. This is a very counterproductive environment. I actually have participated in part of the demands for more detailed rules in my past. I'm kind of sorry I did it, but I was part of that problem. And it's a vicious cycle that we've got to break. IFRS gives us the chance to break the cycle. That by jumping on IFRS, we can get on to a lesser volume of detailed rules. And at the same time, if we have a judgment framework that can help build credibility for the judgments made, we can go from this vicious cycle to a virtuous cycle and get out of this hole. But right now, we're in a hole and we're digging deeper every day.
You know, I'm glad to see you've come around to my view of second-guessing as a bad thing. It almost took an hour, but I'm very grateful.
Can I change my vote?
I don't know. You can do anything you like. Your points, though, one deserves a little bit of reiteration. There is a continuum here of you know, the cookbook, which envisioned sort of Iron Chef-type competition as to who can come up with the best accounting, but principles only without any context, I don't think are standards. I think you have to sort of flesh them out in terms of the reality with some level of guidance. We just can't devolve into hundreds of pages of FAQs or anything like that. And so there's some kind of middle of the road, which we're just going to feel good that we know enough about the essence of the principle that that I think we can all deal with it.
Well, thank you, Greg and Bob, for this excellent conversation. And I should mention that this program will be a valuable addition to the Virtual Museum and Archives' growing collection on accounting. And on behalf of the SEC Historical Society, I'd like to thank Deloitte for its generous support and assistance in making this program possible. I also want to note that the audio of this program is now available on www.sechistorical.org and will be permanently preserved in the museum. In addition, an edited transcript will be available soon on the website. Also, I encourage our audience to listen in next Wednesday, October 28th at 1 p.m. Eastern Time for Deloitte Fireside Chat Part 2, which will explore what we've just been talking about here, principles versus rules-based accounting and auditing standards. Professor Patricia Fairfield of the McDonough School of Business at Georgetown University will be the moderator, and Bob Kippers will be joined by Scott Taub, Managing Director at Financial Reporting Advisors and former acting and deputy chief accountant at the SEC in the Office of the Chief Accountant. Deloitte Fireside Chat Part 2 will also be free and accessible worldwide on, you guessed it, www.sechistorical.org. And you're encouraged to send in your questions to the website by October 27th. So please plan to join us on October 28th. And thank you again for being with us today.